Committee on Energy to order. It is 10 o'clock on Saturday, 10 a.m. Present for the meeting are Representative Tuck, Representative Peterson, Co-Chair Edgman, myself, Representative Millett, and we are here to bring up two items today. We're bringing up House Bill 164 by request of the governor and House Bill 163 on request of the governor. We're going to start this morning with House Bill 164, and here to present the bill is Joe Balash from the governor's office, and I believe, is Harry Noah going to join us?
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay. All right, just state your name and...
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Special Assistant to the Governor for Energy and Natural Resource Issues. The two bills here today before you are components of a three-part plan to initiate an in-state natural gas pipeline project. The first component is a funding request that's been made to initiate work that will help define the need for and the timing necessary to deliver natural gas to Alaskans. That work includes an alternatives analysis, selection of a route, of application for major permits including right-of-way, identification of the source of gas and potential customers, and then bringing all of those pieces together over the next year and a half, 2 years, to create a window of opportunity as early as 2011 to sanction a project. This particular set of work is and work effort is being led by Harry Noah, former commissioner of DNR, who's been appointed project director by Governor Palin. The other two components are bills before you today, one addressing the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority.
And good morning.
Oh, good morning, Representative Ramos. Thanks for joining us. We're just getting a presentation by Joe Balash on House Bill 164.
Thank you. Good morning, Oracle. I'm going to mute myself. Have a nice morning. I'll chime in if I have anything. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you. One bill dealing with the statute and statutory mission of ANGDA, which I understand we'll get to next, and the third bill is, or the third component, second bill, House Bill 164, makes changes necessary to facilitate the commercial relationships that are going to be necessary for a privately constructed and operated pipeline to move forward. Going back to December and January, we began having discussions with interested parties, specifically NSTAR and Anadarko, about a project they were pursuing, a bullet line from Gubik to South Central Alaska along the Parks Highway. But what we wanted to understand from them was, you know, what sort of changes in state law might be necessary to help facilitate a project like the one they were contemplating. And in those discussions that we had were targeting a particular project in mind, but so much of the drafting that's been done was done with that particular framework in mind. However, as we approached the point in time necessary to introduce the bill, Governor Palin asked that we consider the changes in light of some of the other things that she was considering and looking at in terms of gas supply and demand in multiple parts of the state. It's not just about Prudhoe Bay, and it's not just about South Central or Valdez. So we, in the late stages of the drafting process, made the law, the changes applicable to all pipelines in Alaska that begin and end within the state. We did that without necessarily having done a lot of the homework to understand what kind of worms might be crawling out of Cairns and Cook Inlet, where we have some older infrastructure and pre-existing relationships and infrastructure. So we have offered to work with the owners of that infrastructure and identify any concerns that may arise out of these proposed changes. But the bill before you is applicable to all pipelines, not just a bullet line. As we go through the bill, let me say it's a complicated body of law that we're working in, particularly the Pipeline Act. I hope that there's at least one attorney online in case I need a lifeline. But I should be able to answer most of your questions today, and if I'm not able to or if counsel's not able to, we'll be happy to get back to you after the meeting has wrapped up. So House Bill 164. The big picture on House Bill 164 is about access and contractual rights to capacity in a pipeline. For the last 30-plus years, Alaska's Right-of-Way Leasing Act has required the use of common carrier service for anybody who obtains a lease across state line that is building a pipeline. A common carrier is the gold standard of access. Namely, or generally speaking, anybody who shows up with oil or gas to put in that pipeline gets into the pipeline, even if that means the existing shippers have to be prorated. In discussions with NSTAR and Anadarko this year, it became clear that one of the concerns, particularly facing Anadarko, was that if they were going to go spend billions of dollars to develop a new field, they wanted to make sure that they were going to be able to get their gas to market, and they wanted to make sure that they had a contractual right to the capacity in a pipeline that they ship through. That means they can't afford to be prorated under any circumstances, if at all possible. And so with the requirement in state law for right-of-way leases that a pipeline operate as a common carrier, a change was necessary. Now, fortunately, in Title 42 in the Pipeline Act, they do provide for firm service. That's service that can be made available under a contract. But there is not a provision that protects against proration. And so those are the two big things that we were attempting to work out and smooth out here as we sat down to draft the bill that's in front of you. So with that in mind, just sort of walking you through section by section here, the first two sections just make technical references that comply with other changes made in the bill. Section 3 creates a new set of covenants required of a pipeline when they apply to the Department of Natural Resources for a state right-of-way lease. And this is for a pipeline that originates and terminates within the state. And I think it's important that I emphasize that right up front, because we're talking about intrastate pipelines here. We're not talking about the big line. We're not talking about a line that exports LNG to California or Oregon, but just an in-state line, and then go in and make a series of covenant requirements that an applicant walks in the door with. There are 10 of them, and I'll just walk through them quickly, again, because we are sort of stepping down from that gold standard of common carrier to a form of contract carriage. We wanted to make sure that access for new exploration, new development, and new deliveries was going to be possible and protected. So the first step is that the pipeline commit to conducting open seasons on a regular basis to solicit demand. And the second part is that the treatment of those shipping commitments be done in a non-discriminatory fashion. The third part is that they actually pursue expansions whenever they receive commitments from shippers to do so, that they pursue the regulatory authorizations necessary to expand. Number four, that there be transparency in what size the next increment is going to be. If the next engineering increment is 200 million cubic feet per day, and a new shipper only has 100 million cubic feet per day, we don't expect the pipeline to go ahead and expand to the 200. But we need people in the marketplace need to know what that next level of expansion is. Number five, that the pipeline would actually expand on and expand on commercially reasonable terms. And number six, that they commit to utilize rolled-in rates for the pricing of those expansions. And number seven, that they offer a distance-sensitive tariff on their pipeline system. And number eight, that they abide by Alaska Hire, Alaska Business, and in-state hiring facility requirements. Number nine, that they commit to negotiate before construction a project labor agreement. And number 10, that they commit to be regulated, basically acknowledge the jurisdiction of the RCA under Title 42. Now, these 10 items probably look familiar to some of you. They are very, very similar and based on the must-haves that the Palin administration and legislature identified in the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act in 2007. And we took those in mind as we tried to figure out and establish really which parts of that were applicable here.
Joe, just can I interrupt you for 1 second? Representative Dahlstrom has joined us online some time ago, and also Representative Johansson.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I just have one question. You say that this is going to be regulated by RCA. When we were down in D.C., we had talked to FERC about possible oversight based on what type of, if there was a treatment plant or gas to liquids. Have you guys talked to FERC? And they presented us with many scenarios of where FERC would get involved with this project if it were to go forward.
Well, the important language back in the beginning of Section 3 occurs on the end of line 21 and then on into line 22. This is non-competitive lease of state land. I'm sorry.
Is that on page 4?
I'm sorry, page 2.
Page 2, line 20.
Beginning on line 20 down to line 22. A non-competitive lease of state land for right-of-way of a natural gas pipeline valued at $1 million or more, and that originates and terminates within the state. And that's particularly key phraseology that identifies a pipeline that is subject to intrastate jurisdiction, not interstate jurisdiction. There are some circumstances where the FERC might have jurisdiction over some aspect of a pipeline project in Alaska, particularly if you consider either Denali or TC Alaska, the projects they contemplate running down and crossing the border near Tok. A spur line that comes off of that, a project like that in Delta Junction, would then be a pipeline that begins in state, and FERC probably would not have jurisdiction over the spur line. Now, it can get a little bit tricky when you start talking about LNG facilities. FERC does have some siting authority for those facilities, but they don't economically regulate LNG facilities. Where their jurisdiction begins and ends when it comes to an LNG facility is a little bit different than typical pipeline jurisdiction. And it also is not entirely clear how far inland an assertion of FERC jurisdiction can go. And they want to make sure that when the Congress was crafting EPAC, they looked at things like the system of facilities and pipelines that constitute an LNG terminal, but it's not clear that meant an 800-mile pipeline. And so there's some tricky aspects to it.
Yeah, Representative Johansson.
So if this is being, for lack of a better term, sold to us and to the public as as you say, an intrastate pipeline, and you put together all the numbers that you need to do, or whoever's doing it, and they base it on strictly in-state use for, you know, the whole picture to get all the financing and everything and all the deals. I mean, at what point? I guess what I'm saying is that it has to be sold as intrastate from the beginning to the end. And if at some point one molecule starts flowing somewhere out of state, then FERC would probably get involved. But my question is there enough demand in the state where you're going to sell it to the public and everybody else as strictly intrastate? Because if you need to make the financing work to sell it somewhere else, and you strictly build it here with the language that you have in here begins and ends in Alaska, you can say that, but if that doesn't, that's not the reality in the market. Somewhere you have to find some way to find someone else to buy the gas to make it work. Don't you think FERC would be interested and kind of understand that in order for it to work, you're going to have to at some point export? And does that make any sense to you? Because you're a lot smarter than I am about this stuff.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, you're asking the right kind of question in terms of what if the pipeline is going to move more gas than is used here in Alaska. The questions that come up out of that is, okay, when the pipeline service ends, that gas has to go somewhere. And it may get manufactured into a product that is then exported outside of the state. Okay. It may get converted into LNG and then exported from the state. The critical question is going to be, what is the destination of that export? Is that export going to go to East Asia? Is it going to go to the lower 48? Because if it's going to the lower 48, you now are crossing state lines. You're just using water to do it, and FERC would very quickly assert jurisdiction. But until we know more about the commercial aspects of the project, it's going to be difficult for us to assert one way or the other that the FERC does or does not have jurisdiction. And so that's part of what we need to do over the next 2 years here, is identify what it's going to take to have a commercial project, and then understand from there where FERC will and won't have jurisdiction over some aspect of the project.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
So, we don't know the involvement of FERC. No matter what you put in this bill, you can say or hope or put it starts and begins and ends in Alaska, but really until the whole picture comes together, we don't know where FERC comes in. We don't know how far back up the pipeline they go, because, correct me if I'm wrong, if it ends up where, I have no idea, say 30% of this to make the project work needs to be exported somewhere, and that simple fact would probably dictate how involved FERC is going to get, how far, like you say, back up the pipe they're going to go. Are they going to go to Anchorage? Are they going to go to Fairbanks or wherever the line goes? I mean, we're not really going to know how deep FERC is going to be involved until much, much later. Is that kind of what I understand?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about federal lands. If we're going to be building a pipeline 600 miles long across Alaska, the feds own a lot of land in Alaska. And if we end up building this line on federal land, wouldn't FERC automatically be involved?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, it's pretty hard to go very far in Alaska without crossing federal land one way or another. But it's not federal land that triggers the jurisdiction of the FERC. It is the Natural Gas Act, and particularly Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act that regulates the interstate transportation of natural gas. So we will inevitably have to cross at least some amount of federal land, and but that's not the trigger.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you. Joe, just following on Representative Johansson's line of questioning, just so I'm clear, you know, obviously working on enabling legislation at this time, really not having a full or maybe complete picture of what the supply and demand components are going to be. We have some sense, but we don't have a complete picture yet. But my question is, we, from your point of view, know enough to essentially construct the enabling legislation to address the areas in law that we need to make this work with a private partner. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, co-chair Edgman, that's correct. We know that there are parties exploring for gas that want to be able to develop fields and be able to count on capacity. And so what this legislation accomplishes is to allow within our leasing statute and pipeline regulation statute that the kind of commercial contracts required to protect both the shipper as well as those who would be seeking financing in the equity markets, that they be able to put together those contractual instruments that are going to be necessary. In the event it is purely an in-state line and not subject to FERC jurisdiction. So this body of changes would create, in a sense, a framework that would look very familiar to somebody seeking to operate a federal interstate type of project.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
Yeah, I just imagine FERC staying out of FERC is probably a good thing because I think it costs money. It must, and it must make the people who are dealing with them, you know, want to have what you're talking about deal with the state and not have to go back east. But what happens if we get this all figured out and we set it up where we keep the feds out of it as much as possible, which probably makes everybody happy, and we get everything going, we get a gas line built somewhere, and three or four years later, everything kind of changes. And say we find all this gas at Cook Inlet, and we start at the bottom and start going up and pump gas up to Anchorage and Fairbanks that way. Just happens. And then suddenly there's a huge gas reserves that people drill and figure out, and it's more economical to go the other way and then start exporting. I mean, does FERC jump in then, and then we have to jump through a whole bunch of other hoops? And I just want to keep them out. I imagine you probably do, too.
Well, through the chair, Representative Johansson, I think we have a similar mind of that. I've not found anybody that I've come across in Alaska who's looking to bring FERC into this. Some of the questions and scenarios you're throwing out, though, are ones that the governor threw out as well. And again, that's why she wanted to get away from what would be a bullet line specific piece of legislation to one that would be applicable regardless. And to the extent that we can craft an overall state regulatory structure here that has few differences with FERC in the event FERC does step in and assert jurisdiction successfully, we would hope to have as few disruption in any sort of project, because a disruption would likely mean a delay, and that's something that I suspect we want to avoid down the line here.
Representative Johansson.
Again, I'm from hydro country, so this is all kind of Greek to me. But following along with Representative Peterson, if, like you said, you're getting away from the bullet line concept and just kind of basically, what can we figure out that's going to work, no matter what, where the pipes go, up, down, flows, north, south, east, west, whatever. But it all comes down to how much it costs. really. I mean, it's a construction project. And isn't the pipeline corridor permitted? And I mean, wouldn't that be the easiest route? Because you're not crossing any new lands. You're not dealing with any other landholders. You're not going back to the federal government. I mean, logically, to me, that would be the easiest and cheapest route, wouldn't you imagine? Or not? I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, that's a question that the Palin administration has wanted to get a good answer on for the better part of a year. And it may be that a known corridor with well-understood construction techniques is actually going to be the superior path. However, when you measure A to B in pipelining, typically the shortest way to get from A to B is going to cost the least amount of money. Now, that's not true in all cases. And today, we don't know with any real certainty what the differences are between a Parks Highway route or a Richardson Highway route with a spur over from Glen Allen. That is the work that Mr. Noah has already begun to undertake in terms of conducting an understanding of the alternatives and what's there. I think that's the question you were asking. Please let me know if I didn't.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like it'd be cheapest to go down the where we've already got a pipe laid. And was that basically the bullet line?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, when talking about in-state pipelines, there is sort of a common vernacular that would distinguish between an all-Alaska pipeline and a bullet pipeline. And an all-Alaska pipeline is the pipe that would follow the TAPS corridor to Valdez for liquefaction in Valdez. A bullet line is one that would travel down the Dalton Highway through the TAPS corridor, and then at Fairbanks follow the Parks Highway into South Central. So just there aren't any hard rules about which is which, but and I think there may be some blending of the two in the public's mind, but that's been one way that I've distinguished them over the years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Joe, I just have a question. Based on consumption in South Central and through the Rail Belt area, the size of pipe that we're talking about for an in-state line, to be economical, what do you anticipate doing with excess capacity?
Well, that is something that is part of the work plan being pursued here by Mr. Noah. The first thing we need to understand is what is really available in Cook Inlet compared to what's needed and when. Because I think the way he's described it is you don't flip a switch and, you know, on Monday you're using Cook Inlet gas and on Tuesday you're using North Slope gas. There's going to have to be some sort of transition ramp-up period if North Slope gas is going to become the source of supply for South Central. In terms of very rough numbers out there, well, let's take a step back in concept. If you've got a given pipeline that costs $3 billion, the tariff that's going to be charged is going to be computed based on how much gas moves through that pipeline. So you take the amortized cost on a yearly basis and spread that out over the amount of gas that you're moving that year. And so the less gas going in the pipe, the higher the tariff. If that tariff is too high, then the gas that comes out of that pipeline is going to have to command a pretty high price to make it worth putting gas in it 800 miles further up north. So where we think the tipping point might be for North Slope Gas into South Central Markets is somewhere, we think, in the neighborhood of 450 or 500 million cubic feet per day. Higher is better, but the demand for in-state use in South Central today is somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 million cubic feet per day, and I just can't remember if that includes or excludes the LNG plant or the Agrium, the last Agrium load. There is certainly potential for demand to increase and increase by a large margin in Fairbanks. If that community and area were to convert to natural gas, but even with that assumption in mind, and with the existing electricity and heating loads in South Central, we're probably a bridge too far from having enough demand in state all by the residential demand. So there is going to need to be some industrial use or load that helps get enough throughput into the pipe for the tariff to then be economic.
So you're looking for some type of anchor industry, whether it be Conoco, increasing Conoco's export, and that walks right back into we have excess capacity and we're going to have to do something with it, and that brings us back to the question of FERC. If we know that we're going to have an excess capacity, I guess my question to you is, you know, you don't mention FERC, you mention RCA throughout the bill, and I just don't see how we're going to get away with not having some FERC involvement, especially with the excess capacity if we're exporting LNG. Mm-hmm. They told us that they wouldn't get involved in an export of a petro-processed chemical plant, which I understand, but up until this point, the only thing we have to offer is an LNG export.
And Madam Chair, I would only observe that the system and network of pipelines that are presently in Cook Inlet that feed into that LNG plant in Kenai are not regulated by the FERC.
And I understand that, and they have talked, though, about coming and taking over that LNG plant, and it's something that we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. We understand that FERC is on a walking a fine line on making that decision. They talked to us about it when we were down in D.C. So I guess I just wanted to make the committee members aware that there is an issue with FERC, that there is a possibility that FERC will come over and oversee an in-state pipeline with the capacity that we're talking about to make it economical and commercial, that there is that recognition that we may be under the thumb of FERC again.
That could happen. And we're trying to our best to prepare for that, to prevent it from happening. But if it does, that any path that we go out on here from an in-state perspective is one that does not require a sea change in approach or planning or reordering the commercial terms between the parties.
Okay. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe that our export license for LNG was only extended for a couple of years, to 2011. Is that correct? So if we are talking about building a line that's going to take 3 or 4 years to build, we would have to get that extended to continue doing the exports. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Peterson, that's probably correct. Whether the facility would operate continuously, whether it would ramp down or go into some sort of warm status, is going to be dependent upon the availability of gas locally in the Cook Inlet market to continue operating. But again, even that is going to present some commercial challenge is, just as I described earlier, you're not going to go from Monday to Tuesday Cook Inlet gas to North Slope gas. There's going to need to be some means of transitioning, and whether or not the Kenai facility is built for another 30 years of operation, I'm not here to even begin to tell you whether it could or would.
Okay. Representative Johansson?
Yeah, thanks. I've been approached over the last month by groups outside outside of Juneau that have come down to Juneau. I've had legislators in the building who are supporting this in-state line, I mean, to the point where you just want to duck into a room when you see them walking down the hallway, because you know that's what they're going to talk about. And I think it's a real concern about keeping finding enough demand, because they keep trying to sell me on exporting gas, well, not exporting because it's in-state, but moving gas from the end of the line into Southeast Alaska, and asking how do I feel about gasifying Ketchikan and Juneau and Wrangell when and to me it's kind of almost an act of desperation, because obviously if we're pumping 500 through the pipe and you said the demand is 2-something, and you know, maybe we can push that up a little bit, but then we're talking about the balance of tariffs, and that gets into whether it's going to economically work or not. Does gasifying any other part of the state somehow fit into kind of the vision of what the third floor is looking at? Are you guys seriously talking about gasifying Southeast Alaska or the Aleutian Chain or out there by Nome? And I mean, is any of that part of the idea of trying to bump up demand so we're not, one, in the middle of FERC, and two, trying to get some gas to other areas that need it? Because I think it's just, frankly, kind of ridiculous to think you're going to pipe Southeast Alaska with an inch of topsoil and 10,000 miles of granite. I don't know how you do it, but maybe I'm missing something. I mean, is that part of the conversation?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, you're beginning to touch on some of the issues raised in the second bill that we're going to talk about today.
Oh, okay.
But in terms of the opportunity to deliver natural gas or propane to communities as an alternative to diesel, certainly I would say that the Palin administration sees a need, in fact an imperative, for communities in rural Alaska to move off of diesel wherever possible. We are enjoying a temporary relief right now due to the price of crude oil, but we don't expect that that's going to last indefinitely. And with the alternatives available to communities, we hope that they are able to make a switch, of their choice. But natural gas, propane, biomass gas, there are opportunities available to get gas to communities. Whether or not Southeast is suited to that, I'm not here to tell you it is or it isn't, but I know of at least one propane distributor company utility that has certificates for a number of communities in Southeast Alaska that believes it's possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sure it is in certain pockets, if I might. And it does leak over into the second piece of legislation. But it all goes back, as you well know, to how much we're pumping through the pipe. And if we can't find enough demand, and I think that's why people are sniffing around Southeast and they're sniffing around other places to try and
fill that pipe up so we don't end up having to export to make the money work, and then we've got FERC right back in. I mean, to me, it just, you've got to find a place to put the gas, and if you can't do it in-state, you got to do it out-of-state, and, I mean, we're right back where we started from. So, I don't know.
Madam Chair, just for what it's worth, the moment gas leaves Alaska as an export does not automatically trigger FERC jurisdiction. If it is going to be an international destination, an international destination only, then there is a reasonable chance that FERC would not have jurisdiction. So, for instance, if a long-term contract were put in place to supply Kogas or Mitsubishi in Japan, we would have an argument, basically, that says we are not transporting gas to another state. And because we are not, you, FERC, do not have jurisdiction under Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act. So that is something that, until we get further down the road and know what those commercial arrangements are or are not going to be, you know, I can't give you a whole lot of comfort that we're going to be able to keep FERC out, but...
Madam Chair.
Joe, I'm going to switch up just a little bit on you.
I'm sorry, I just had one more question.
Oh, go ahead, Representative Johansson.
And so that would get us back to the discussion back east about export licenses and what about those hungry markets we keep hearing about down in the Midwest? Because that's the farm lobby, and if they we all know how strong they are, and we heard a lot during the last couple years on various venues across the country about those hungry markets in the Midwest. So I know you guys know the challenges, but that one concerns me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just for edification of the committee, the pursuit of a large diameter natural gas pipeline is and remains the priority of the Palin administration. Exactly when that will happen is under some question, but we expect that it will happen. We continue to put effort into making it happen. Having said that, it's not a certainty, and so we want to be prepared and on a parallel path, as it were, with an in-state line and project that is going to be ready to go in the event we don't see enough certainty in 2011 or thereafter on a large project.
Can I just follow up, please?
Representative Johansson.
I'm sorry. Okay. So do you see challenges if you do go back east and you're pushing and lobbying as the governor should, as she does, for not only the big line and simultaneously asking for an export license? Do you believe that we can convince and talk to legislators, congressmen and senators, and their constituency, most importantly, to make them understand that you can have both? You guys think you can do that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. The potential for Alaska to deliver gas from a variety of sources is unparalleled, particularly, and this is where it becomes sort of a fine line with some of the interests in Washington, D.C., but the OCS area holds tremendous potential for natural gas, and as natural gas hydrates in particular become more and more viable from a commercial perspective, not just a technical perspective, the numbers for gas hydrates in and around Alaska measure into the tens of thousands of trillion cubic feet. What we're talking about with our large diameter pipeline is going to require something like 55 trillion cubic feet over 30 years. We have upwards of 34 trillion cubic feet known on the North Slope. That number is expected to exceed 200 trillion cubic feet when people actually get out and start looking hard for natural gas, and those are just conventional plays. So the opportunity for natural gas from Alaska to flow to hungry markets in North America, but also to some of the premium markets in other parts of the Pacific Rim, we believe both options and opportunities are there if we proceed with the right kind of transportation that explorers can count on gaining access to.
I guess I must have learned too much back east and listening to Gia, because I feel like I could go on for a long time, but I'm not going
to. Representative Johansson, your brain has grown.
My skull is the same size.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ask this few questions on the right-of-way portion. Currently, the gas lines that we have in the state of Alaska, do they operate in the common carrier mode as far as the right-of-way provisions?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, they do have a common carrier covenant on their state leases where state leases are involved. My understanding, however, is that there has been, over the years, at least in some cases, the use of disputes and settlements to work around that requirement. But it requires first a dispute to be taken either to the RCA or to the courts.
And can you give me an example of a dispute that a court would see underneath the common carrier for natural gas lines?
I don't have a specific example in mind. I'm generally aware, though, of some of the lines from Beluga that move into South Central. I couldn't tell you who the parties were. I know that there were disputes over there, and the owner of that line, once they went through the hoops, as it were, and offered service to other parties, did not see the kind of demand that perhaps was contemplated or argued in the disputes earlier. But I'd have to go back and do some homework on the exact parties.
Madam Chair.
Representative Tuck.
So are most of the disputes regarding access onto that line to receive some perceived customers? Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, my understanding is that it is a third-party shipper that wants to use an original party as pipeline to move their gas into a market, be it the NSTAR home heating market or into with one of the electric utilities, or as an independent, as I think Aurora has gone sort of right over the top of NSTAR and using the NSTAR common carrier pipelines, but to move gas to customers and sort of eliminate NSTAR as the middleman.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tuck.
Oh, no, I got
you. Oh, go ahead, Representative Tuck. Go ahead. Absolutely.
So with the existing common carrier lines that we have, with this piece of legislation, would it affect those in existence as well?
Madam Chair, through the chair, Representative Tuck, the new requirements in Section 121 would not apply retroactively to state leases already issued. However, the changes made in the Pipeline Act in 4206, those changes would apply. And in particular, I think that the change in definitions contemplated in Section 8 and the change in definition in Section 9 could or would have an effect on existing pipelines.
Madam Chair?
Representative Tech, you bet.
So are we trying to eliminate potential lawsuits? Is that what this whole right-of-way thing is? Is it going to make it easier for, is it trying to clean up the right-of-way situation? And how is that going to affect the open season and allowing competition? If you don't mind me asking it all in one last final blow.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Through the chair, are we trying to avoid conflicts and disputes? Yes, we are. But what we're really trying to do is create the regulatory environment that allows commercial parties to enter the kind of arrangements that are going to be necessary for a privately based project to move forward. And to do so in a manner that preserves a high degree of access for third parties, because we as a state have an interest in the undeveloped land and resources. We don't care who develops them, we just want it to be done on a competitive basis so that it actually happens. And as long as there's access available through these, for all intents and purposes, monopolized transportation systems, then we can encourage the more activity that might be possible depending upon market circumstances.
Madam Chair, one follow-up.
Representative?
So this is eliminating the monopoly, or is this actually creating more of a monopoly? Because my understanding is the common carrier, anyone can potentially get on a pipeline if they have a supply and can demonstrate demand. The disputes has been whether or not the pipeline transportation company would allow them to. This right away eliminating the carrier common carrier provisions for natural gas pipelines would make it so whatever's been negotiated in advance takes precedence, unless I'm misunderstanding. But wouldn't that be creating more of a monopoly? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, there is a difference here, and as far as the label monopoly goes. You know, there are certain types of business activities in this state that we just go ahead and concede are monopolies, and that's why the RCA regulates them. Whether it's trash pickup service, water service, or home heating service, right? That the RCA does regulate things that would otherwise be monopolies, and natural gas pipelines are one of those things. So we, in 1972 or 1974, as a state, adopted this Right-of-Way Leasing Act and said there will be common carrier service for pipelines that cross state right-of-way. And there are people out there who will argue whether it has or has not been a successful model for encouraging third parties to develop oil and gas resources to get them to market. But what this set of changes would do is say, okay, we're going to move away from the common carrier in word, but not in spirit. The changes that we're contemplating here, we're asking the legislature to consider, would require that a pipeline owner conduct open seasons and offer their capacity on a non-discriminatory basis in a fashion that would hopefully, and we expect, would encourage third parties to go find and develop additional supplies of gas and bring them into the existing system of pipelines.
And follow up one more time, I'm sorry. The RCA Commission has, as far as if I can remember correctly, they did a presentation, I don't know if it was in this committee or resources, but they did a presentation on when they begin to regulate, and I can't remember if it was refined gas or if it was natural gas, but my question is with the provisions that you have right here, where this will operate much like a, as you mentioned, a garbage utility or a water utility and so on and so forth, well, because that's a form of, some sort of form of monopoly, but in the public's best interest. With this, how is RCA's authority going to be affected with the changes from common carrier? Is it going to be more oversight, less oversight, about the same of what we have existing?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I don't think there's anything in here that fundamentally alters the RCA's authority. In fact, it's one of the things that is in some ways a little bit out of sync between the Right-of-Way Act and the Pipeline Act. The Pipeline Act, which is where the RCA acts, already provides for firm transportation service. The State Right-of-Way Leasing Act, however, does not. And so trying to harmonize these things is really what we're trying to accomplish. The RCA would still have authority to regulate the tariffs and contracts between the shippers and pipe companies. So I'm not going to speak for the RCA here. They're capable of speaking for themselves. But I do not believe that this in any way diminishes their ability to regulate natural gas pipelines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bayless. Appreciate it.
Representative, any other questions? I just want to, could you walk us through your reasonings for putting in rolled-in rates as opposed to incremental rates? And then I also have a question about demonstrate a market demand on commercially reasonable terms. And who would be making that determination? And is there a definition for commercially reasonable terms somewhere that you can point us to?
Sure. Okay. Would you like me just to walk through the individual pieces or just the rolled-in rates pieces in Section 3?
Yeah, if you could just walk us through the reasoning behind rolled-in rates versus incremental rates. And,
sure.
And I guess while we're doing that, you also have distance-sensitive rates in statute. So maybe you can explain to the committee the reasoning behind all three of those, two that are in statute, and then why not incremental rates?
Okay. The rolled-in rates section contained in 35.121, going back to our starting point here with common carrier access, we're taking a step back from, again, what I said was the gold standard. When a pipeline that transports oil or gas is put into service, it is one that can be used to transport what is a valuable commodity to market. And it's very important to anybody who wants to find and develop oil or gas. It's the access to that pipeline that is important. Common carrier service allows somebody to step into the pipeline and be treated exactly the same way on day one, and you then live with the constraints of the pipeline as it is. And so if there is no more room, the existing shippers are prorated down. So in moving away from that common carrier regime, you move to this contractual regime where conceivably a pipeline can be filled up, but all of the people in that pipeline, all of the shippers in that pipeline, have firm service that can't be prorated down. So we would then have a situation where a third party, a new party, wants to move gas from the production area to the market and is not able to get into the pipe physically. So the only way to get that gas into the pipe is for the pipe to expand. And when that pipe expands, the question is, how is it going to be done? By adding compression, which probably is going to wind up lowering the toll, or by adding additional pipe at a bottleneck area through and accomplishing looping. And when you roll those rates all together, everybody pays the same. And so this is, in a form, getting and preserving what we already have in common carrier, in that everybody's treated the same. We do recognize, however, that rolling in can result in an increase in cost that is not contemplated by the original shippers, the original parties that enter into the arrangements that actually get the pipeline to happen. And so we have laid out in here a basis for putting a cap on how much of that roll-in effect can take place, so that when they run their initial economics and look out over a long period of time, the period of their transportation commitment, they can run through the scenario where more gas shows up, the pipe gets expanded, they roll in the rates, but it will only roll in up to a certain point. Or after is predictability, so that people can make decisions and understand how circumstances might change. And from the tariff perspective, it's a question of whether or not the tariff is going to change a little or a lot. We think 115% is not insignificant, but it's not a lot. And so it was the figure that we had used when putting together AGEA. And if it was good enough for a big line, it was good enough for a smaller line. On distance-sensitive rates, again, this goes back to a question of an item that the state of Alaska has commented on previously, back during FERC's consideration of regulations for an Alaska natural gas pipeline. Distance-sensitive rates was something that both the executive branch and the legislative branch said was a good thing, that gas that was going into the pipeline in Prudhoe but being taken off in Fairbanks shouldn't have to pay the same freight as gas that's going to Chicago. Well, in this case, in an in-state line, the same general principle applies. And one way to look at it is, if we had a bullet line from Prudhoe Bay to South Central Alaska, and the folks from Doyon struck a large field in Nenana, when they bring their gas in to move to market, should they have to pay for the 400 miles they didn't use? Or should they just have to pay for the 350 miles from Nenana down to market? So, in terms of encouraging exploration and development at all points along the pipeline route, and also the markets all along the route, it seemed a matter that made sense. Again, looking, I talked about, you know, the difference between shippers, producers, you know, somebody at Prudhoe Bay versus somebody at Nanana. You can then look at it from the consumer side of things, the customer side of things. And if gas is going to come off at the Yukon River Bridge and then be moved up and down the river on barges to communities, you know, they should not have to pay the full distance all the way down to Anchorage and be able to take advantage of just that short haul distance in terms of their transportation costs. So that's the rationale, the reasoning behind distance sensitive rates.
So let me pose a question to you then. Commercially reasonable terms, if someone discovers gas and they need expansion on the pipe and it's not the less expensive compression, it's going to be looping, and they commit their gas to Fairbanks, but the looping causes rolled-in rates to increase all the way to the end of the pipe for the other shippers. How are you going to regulate that instance where a new shipper is coming on board but only using 400 miles of the pipe? Everybody else is being charged for that expansion all the way to the 800-mile end, and the distance-sensitive rates for that shipper is just the rolled-in rates to 400 miles. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I believe I do, and I would direct you to Section 4 of the bill on pages 6 and 7. Commercially reasonable terms means that the revenue from the transportation contracts covers the cost of the expansion. And the definition for reasonable engineering increment would also come into question. And so I think the hypothetical, if I understand what you're saying, is going to depend on what has to be added where along the pipe. Because if you've got a distance-sensitive tariff, you've got basically zones for delivery, and then they all add up to a single charge. And these are the things that the RCA would go in and identify which costs apply to which particular delivery zone and which ones don't.
So who's determining the commercially reasonable term?
Well, the commercially reasonable term is something that's defined in the statute, and that is then used by the RCA when and if the RCA is called on to enforce the terms of the lease covenants.
So RCA is using the definition of I'm sorry, I didn't see
the. It's the combination of the commercially reasonable terms and the engineering increments. And this, I'm stretching my capacity for regulatory rate making proceedings, but in looking at the total system, they look at who is the cost causer, and they become the cost payer. And if you are causing a particular cost, you pick it up. In a pipeline setting, if everybody's putting in their gas at the top end of the pipe and everybody's bringing it out at the bottom end, then everybody pays all of those costs together. It all just gets divvied up. If, however, you start looking at segmented delivery points both in and out of the pipe, then the RCA will have to look at those things which are caused by just pieces of the pipe and how to allocate those costs throughout.
So the in your description, the cost, the group that's costing the increase is paying the increase, but enrolled in rates, everybody pays the cost for someone new entering the pipe. So it's not a cost pay situation, it's a rolled in rate. So
someone's committed their gas in 2009 at whatever their commercial terms are, their shipping rates are. Three people add in, it causes looping, and so now everybody's paying those rolled-in rates. Everybody's paying the increase to have those three new shippers come into the pipe. But you just explained your scenario where it was a cost, the cost increaser was a cost payee, and that's not true in rolled-in rates.
Well, it is in that everybody's benefiting from the increased compression moving the gas through the pipe. When three new entrants come in, if compression has to be added, that sometimes, in some ways, makes the pipe system more efficient. In other words, you're moving more gas through the system at a comparable or relative cost. And that means when you spread it all out, the overall toll goes down.
But that's only in compression. That's not in looping.
That is usually the case.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. And so when you go back to where we are today, is common carrier. And if a pipeline were to happen today on that basis, the original shippers would be at risk of being prorated when new shippers wanted to show up. They are gaining the certainty that their capacity will not be prorated. But they are also gaining the certainty that if new shippers come in and costs increase, their costs will not go higher than 115%.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative Feck.
Okay. In just what your summary was just a moment ago, that's the benefit of going off the common carrier, is that the shipper, not shipper, but the suppliers are no longer forced to take a prorated percentage going down the line. They're guaranteed that they can take, that when new shippers come online, that they're not going to be reduced in capacity. In exchange for having to potentially cover additional costs when new suppliers come on, but not more than 115%. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Do you want to finish? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you for so long, but do you want to finish walking through the section?
Not even sure where I was. I think that I had wrapped up the description of the covenants in Section 121. So in Section 4 of the bill on page 6, on line 30, there are two definitions added, commercially reasonable terms and reasonable engineering increments. Those terms are used in the new Section 121, and so we wanted to make sure that the definitions were clear. Section 5, this is where we start into the Pipeline Act, and this particular section of the Pipeline Act spells out some very specific and particular things that a type of pipeline, a North Slope natural gas pipeline, which has its own special definition in 4206, the way it has to conduct its business. And this clause here at the beginning of 240F just spells out that if something in the covenants in 121 create a conflict with this particular section of statute, that the covenants in 121 govern. Just, we didn't want to have a conflict between one statute and another, and so we don't want to confuse the RCA, because anyway.
Hey Joe, it looks like it is a little after 11, and we still need to hear that. Mm-hmm. Other bills. So do you want to continue until 11:30, and then we'll move on to the next bill, and
sure.
We'll just put this one aside. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Section 6 on page 9 allows for a conditional certificate to be awarded by the RCA. And the easiest way to talk about this is to talk about a conditional right-of-way lease that DNR issues. And And a number of years ago, ENGDA went out and secured a conditional right-of-way lease across the Glen Highway, or following the Glen Highway route. And basically, they were able to go to DNR and say, here's all these things, but we're missing X or Y or Z. And the commissioner of DNR issued a conditional lease that says, if you satisfy this condition and that condition, your lease is final. What we want to do is allow for the RCA to do the same thing. And this fits in with the overall and larger plan of trying to get major permits filed and underway as soon as this year for an in-state project so that we can get as far along as possible and be basically ready to go in 2011. And a conditional certificate would be one of those things that a state entity could file for and receive and say, we don't have our financing, but here's how it's going to work. Can we have a conditional certificate if we show, and then the burden is to go get the financing.
And is this a new certificate? Is this something that the RCA can right now issues?
Madam Chair, in order for anybody to construct a pipeline, they need to receive a certificate from the RCA.
And more than one pipeline, if there's a competing pipeline, there could be two certificates issued?
That could happen.
Okay.
Section 7 allows the RCA to enforce the terms of Section 121 back in Title 38. And that's where you wouldn't want to have a set of contractual commitments made between the pipeline and DNR. It wouldn't be necessarily DNR carrying out the enforcement of that. DNR could, but wouldn't always. This would allow RCA to do it in the course of the rest of their regulatory activities of the pipeline on an annual basis. And then Section 8, this is a definition in the Pipeline Act for firm transportation service. Again, firm service is something that's not new in the Pipeline Act, but we wanted to make sure that we are protecting firm service shippers against pro rata reductions. And so this language here that's been added accomplishes that. And then in Section 9, common carrier is defined to include both firm and interruptible transportation service.
Okay, is there any questions from the committee?
I had a question, Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson?
Peterson beat me to it, though, if he wants to go first.
Go ahead, I'll be next.
Okay. Just back to the conversation we had on rolled in rates and the distance charging. And I hate to do this, but I've been waiting for months to do this to Joe. Can I call you Joe? Because I've been practicing a few zingers for you.
Oh my gosh.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, you can call me whatever you need to.
Thank you, Joe.
Can I call you Joe?
You described very well the interpretation of the give and take on the rolled-in rates. You said we have rolled-in rates, and the people who put the initial cash down and have the initial risk for actually constructing this, I believe you said something to the effect of the ones who initially made the decisions that made the pipeline possible. So you've thought out a give and take on the rolled-in rates is how it seemed like you articulated. What's the give and take on the distance, the decision to have distance-sensitive charges? What's the give and take on that?
Well,
or is there any?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, the give and take, as it were, is that the users of pipeline capacity pay for what they need to use. And if, for instance, there was a a pipeline that went from Prudhoe Bay down the Parks Highway into South Central, and then took a hard right and proceeded west out to the Donlin Creek Mine. You would have a situation where gas is starting up north and flowing all the way out to Donlin, and the question would be, since not all of the gas would flow all the way to Donlin, who should have to pay for the gas that goes to Donlin, that extra cost? And the folks in Anchorage probably wouldn't want their bills to be higher in order to get gas out to Donlin. And so it's a matter of segmenting the pipe for the service required, whether you're somebody putting gas in at a particular point or taking it out at a particular point. You basically, you're paying for what you use.
So,
Representative Johansson?
It doesn't matter either way whether you're taking it out or putting it in, then. Is that what you're telling me?
That's correct. In terms of the rationale for distance sensitive rates on a pipeline of this type.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking here in Section 8, and you're talking about that hazard tracing service is not, it wouldn't be a reduction unless the pipeline's capacity was diminished. And what type of scenario would have to would we have to be in for there to be a pipeline capacity diminished?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, one hypothetical that comes to mind is an 800-mile pipeline that has 4 compressor stations. And 2 of those compressor stations go down. Then physically, the pipe is not able to move the same amount of gas, and so that would be a physical diminishment. And so we can't make the pipeline do what it can't do.
Right. Okay. Just wasn't sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Is that Edmund? No. And Joe, I just a simple question. We're talking about an in-state pipeline. We have the AGEA project going forward. Do you see the in-state pipeline jeopardizing the large AGEA line? Do you think that they can work hand in hand? Do you think by taking off gas from the north now with the in-state pipeline, while we are still in litigation with Point Thompson, when that could go on for years, do you think that there's enough gas for both projects to go forward?
Through the chair, to the chair, Representative Millett, the potential for the North Slope to deliver extremely large volumes of natural gas in multiple directions to multiple markets is something that we believe very strongly in. But that is a long-term view. Today, would be challenged to deliver 7.5 billion cubic feet on a daily basis to multiple markets. And probably in the near term would be challenged to deliver that kind of volume. Whether or not an in-state bullet line, as it were going to cause any kind of a challenge, problem for the larger pipeline is going to be a question that takes into account 2 different numbers. The first number is, what size of large diameter pipe are we talking about? Is it going to be a 48-inch pipe? And are we talking about delivering 3.5 billion cubic feet per day as a minimum? Or does it have to reach 4 billion or even 4.5 billion per day as a minimum. So there's that sensitivity on the big pipe that matters. When we examined the application of TC Alaska, they came in and said 3.5 is a minimum. Well, 3.5 is a lot easier to get to than 4.5. Conversely, going back to the question that you asked earlier about what volume is required for a bullet line to be economic, we think that that number is somewhere between 400 and 500 million cubic feet per day. We don't have a hard handle on that. It may be more, it may be less. We don't have a tremendous handle on that.
I have a question on that. With the constraints of AGIA, can an in-state pipeline be more than half of BCF a day? You say it can be more, but under the license that we awarded TransCanada, I think we assured them that...
Well, this is something that, if you'll give me just a moment to explain, I'll be happy to. The 500 million cubic feet per day limit in AGIA goes to an assurance that we've provided our partners, the licensees, that we will not throw the state's powers, benefits, whatever, behind a different competing project while they are still commercially pursuing their own. And so the way that's spelled out specifically in the statute is that we will not grant favorable tax or royalty terms to a competing project or provide a grant of state cash to a competing project. If an in-state project is developed and moves ahead without any additional state support, concession, or treatment of taxes or royalties or cash considerations by the state of Alaska, it could be 1.2 BCF a day, and it doesn't affect the state's project assurance clause in the AGIA license.
So as long as we don't incentivize, we don't make any special exceptions, we don't change the tax structure specifically for the bullet line, we can have a bullet line larger than half a BCF.
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay.
Madam Chair, on that?
Representative Tuck.
Thank you. You said 2.5 billion could be. Is that a point of demarcation for that, or is that just an arbitrary number that you said? It can just be anything above a half a billion.
Through the chair, Representative.
Did I say 2.5 trillion? I meant to say 2.5 billion is what I meant to say.
Through the chair, Representative Tucker, 2.5 billion cubic feet per day for, I'm not sure what the reference
is. Oh, you dropped a number. You said that if they didn't, there was no Alaska incentives, if there was no Alaska participation, it could be 2.5. I'm just wondering where you came up with that number. Was that just an arbitrary number? It can be anything over a half a billion? Or is that a point?
It was an arbitrary number.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, might there be a question as to what the definition of incentives is? Because some might construe the fact that the state is maybe lending some bonding capacity for $4 billion to be financed to build this line. Could that be construed as giving them incentives and therefore breaking the contract?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, the AGIA statute, and I should have brought it with me, is very specific in identifying tax or royalty treatment or modifications and or a grant of state cash. Might a licensee look at that and say the spirit includes many other things? Well, hopefully we don't have to ponder that or worry about that. If, however, we face a point in time here in 2011 or beyond where the legislature and administration are faced with that kind of prospect, there will probably be any number of lawyers looking at that question very hard.
Thank you.
I just have one more question.
You talked about the 34 TCF of known reserves on the North Slope. Were you including Point Thompson in your?
I was.
Oh. And with that, is there any other questions from the committee?
No, ma'am.
Representative?
No, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Okay. With that, we will hold on to House Bill 164. And you have 30 minutes, Joe, to present us HB 163.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 163 is a, as I said at the top of the morning here, or the beginning of this particular committee hearing, one of three components in the governor's plan to initiate an in-state natural gas project. And the bill is relatively short and straightforward and largely speaks for itself. Just by way of background, in 2002, an initiative was placed on the ballot for the voters' consideration to create the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. And that original language, I believe, specified that the authority pursue a project that would go from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez and provide a spur line to South Central. And in, I believe it was 2004, the legislature changed that statutory mission to and expanded it to include consideration of a pipeline that would travel to Cook Inlet, not just Prince William Sound. And that, as I recall, that legislation passed both the House and the Senate without objection. There were not any no votes cast on that particular legislation. So here we are today, and in looking at the energy needs of Alaskans, the opportunities of moving gas from one place to another, the potential ways that ANGDA might be used or useful in getting gas to Alaskans, we have taken a look at the statutory mission and decided it best to open up the horizon here, to, you know, take the blinders off of the horse. ANGDA can be a very powerful tool, a very useful tool to do some of the pre-development activities such as those ANGDA is already doing on a spur line. We just think that there's an opportunity to make the statute more flexible than it presently is and allow the agency to be a robust engine here in the state of Alaska.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
I have one single line of questioning I'd like to get out of the way so all you oil and gas geniuses can talk about stuff.
Representative Johansson.
You don't mind, because I feel like I don't understand half of what's going on here. When was this enacted by initiative? You mentioned that, but I...
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, it was on the ballot in 2002 at the general election.
2002, and this is 2008. If I may continue.
Through the chair.
Representative Johansson.
Sorry, I believe it's 2009.
It is 2009. See?
Wow.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Long night. And it was amended. When was the amendment done that you just spoke about? That was unopposed.
I believe it was a piece of legislation in 2004.
2004. Okay. If I may continue.
So
this is statute that was enacted by Citizen Initiative, correct?
That is correct.
And this is a proposal by the governor to amend a Citizens Initiative, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, that is correct.
And is that because there is new information or changing environment affecting how this statute that was put into effect by the citizens over time, things have changed and the legislature and the governor have the power to amend language that was put into effect by initiative because of changing times and conditions?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I think that that is part of the considerations, yes. In other ways, I would say that anybody who has children is familiar with the adage, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And when examining some of the things that the agency has been up to, investigations of propane or examining pipelines to Western Alaska, they go beyond the strict structure of the statutory mission of ANGDA. And in some cases, the legislature has been fully aware of their desire to and eventual movement on propane exploration and has funded the agency with full knowledge of that. Likewise, the work that they have begun to think about anyway with regard to Western Alaska was at least initiated by correspondence from a legislator, but there was not any discussion of that in the context of budget hearings when appropriations were made. And so it is altogether easier for us to just go ahead and take the blinders off of this horse and let it see the field and become a vehicle for getting gas from anywhere in Alaska, not just Prudhoe Bay, to anywhere in Alaska, not just Tidewater or South Central.
Madam Chair,
Representative Johansson.
I appreciate that, and I, you know, as far as getting down into the details of what's happened in the past, I'm not really getting down into that. I just think it's a valid point that an initiative was passed, and one could argue that every single person who voted for that wanted exactly that and no changes to it. But with changing times, I think it's certainly valid for the governor and for the legislature to readdress the statute and adjust it to the realities that surround it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johansson. Any other questions? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if, say, a company happened to find a decent-sized pool of natural gas down in the Cook Inlet region or Clam Gulch or somewhere in the Kenai Peninsula, and they only needed to build 20 or 25 miles or 30 miles of pipeline to hook into our current pipelines, this would be allowable under this scenario and with the HB 163?
Chair, Representative Peterson, that's correct. In Section 1, the underlined language or other regions within the state would allow the folks at ANGDA to look beyond the North Slope for their gas supply, as it were.
Right. So we wouldn't be required to build a 400, 500, 600-mile pipeline if sufficient quantities of gas were found closer to an existing pipeline.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Joe, question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
When the initiative passed, one of the requirements of ANGDA was to develop a project plan for a gas line. And the gas was to be flowing in 2007. Can you just give us a quick rundown from 2002 to now, how much money the state has appropriated to ANGDA, what their work product is,
And can you just walk us through maybe some of their major accomplishments in the last 7 years and the value that ANGTA provides to the state? And I think we have Harold Hines online, too, if we need to talk to him. But could you just kind of give us an overview of the birth of ANGTA and its infancy and now to its 2009?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm happy to do what I can off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite as good as Bill Stoltz, but I remember a lot of things. and then if I miss anything, and Harold is online, he's been there from the beginning and probably has a better list than I do. But the initiative was passed in 2002, and that coincided with the change in administration. Governor Frank Murkowski was elected, came into office, and appointed a board of directors in conformance with the initiative mandate. A relatively modest appropriation was included that year to fund the agency to go out and do the work required under the initiative. The original initiative called on ANGTA to investigate the feasibility of and economic viability of a pipeline project described in the initiative, that being one from Prudhoe Bay to Tidewater at Prince William Sound with a spur line to South Central. They did that work. They prepared, as I recall, a report to Alaskans. It was disseminated widely throughout the state, may have even been an insert in some newspapers. I just can't recall whether that happened in 2004. I believe it was 2004 that happened. In 2004, the legislature then examined potential changes to the statutory framework of ANGTA and expanded the scope of what they may or may not do. 2004 is also when applications began to at least be contemplated for submission under the Stranded Gas Development Act. I think, in fact, 2004 there were some. And it was very clear that a large diameter pipeline was the priority of that particular administration, that they were negotiating with multiple parties and multiple fronts. And so ANGTA then, as I recall, began to focus on being the vehicle to provide the spur line service that would ensure gas from a big line made it to South Central Alaska, to provide gas to Alaskans. Along the way, they looked at opportunities for petrochemical development and other uses of the natural gas. They also started to look at the potential for propane and propane distribution along the coasts and rivers in rural Alaska. And then as the 2005-2006 period continued and focus on the SGDA contract continued, ANGTA continued to focus on that spur line work. Along the way in that period, they did apply for and secure from DNR a conditional right-of-way lease along the Glen Highway, and that's to facilitate their spur line project. And then in 2006, at the end of 2006, Governor Palin was elected, and the first 2 days of her administration, she spent meeting with all interested parties, including Harold Hines and members of the board, I believe, from ANGTA, and asked them whatever happened to the original ANGTA project, because they were very focused on the spur line and had been, and I think that renewed their zeal with which they look at all things gas and see a role for themselves. And in 2007, funding was added by the legislature well above and beyond what the governor had requested. And as I understand it, that funding was in part used to develop an application that was submitted under the terms of AGEA. But because it was not a project that began in Prudhoe Bay, it was found to be non-compliant when we did our initial review of applications submitted in late 2007. And so in early 2008, their application was rejected for non-compliance.
Question on that. So they put an application in to build a pipeline? ANGA was going to be the construction?
They put in an application that would allow them to build the spur line either along the Glen Highway connecting to one of the LNG applicants or to continue up the Richardson Highway to Delta Junction to connect to one of the large North American projects. But they did not have, so they had the two scenarios. They did not have a third that would involve going all the way up to Prudhoe.
So ANGDA would own and build a pipeline? Was that the idea?
You're taxing my memory. I think they have routinely presented their project as a turnkey project, that they were doing the pre-development work necessary to turn it over to a private developer, private owner, operator. But
build it and they will come?
Sorry. I just had to ask.
That's a good movie.
And so then in 2008, they still had funds on hand, but they were hard charged and ready to go on spur line work with the identification of TransCanada Alaska as the licensee under AGEA. We asked the folks at ANGDA for an estimation of the funds they would need to basically get to work and be, you know, more or less uninterrupted between the summer of 2008 and the open season in 2010 under the AGEA open season terms. They identified that. We did not request the full sum, but we did make a large request as part of our overall appropriations request in the special session of 2008. And here we are in 2009. One thing that's not ANGDA specific but touches on this overall in-state gas line question is at the end of last session in 2008, the legislature passed a resolution on in-state gas, something that the governor took notice of, and she requested then $10 million from the legislature to identify the economics and scope of various projects for in-state delivery of gas, looking at both the Parks and Richardson Highway routes and comparing the economics and examining the feasibility of standalone. That request, however, was not granted. As I recall, in House Finance, the funding was reduced from 10 to ultimately $4 million and directed specifically at ANGDA rather than the governor's office.
So
in total, the authority has been appropriated something in the neighborhood of $10 million. I don't know if it's a little less or a little more than that. I understand they have not an insignificant amount of funds available to them that are not presently obligated or encumbered. But they are champing at the bit, ready to go on sort of the next stage of work in pursuit of the spur line project. And along the way, we have done our best to keep an eye on both the statutory mission as well as the purpose behind specific appropriations made by the legislature to determine whether or not we can move forward on one thing or another. And I think I touched on the things you needed me to, but maybe not.
Okay, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your description of ANGDA getting involved with the GIA process, there was also Alaska Port Authority, Alaska Gas Port Authority as well, right? And so, okay, I just want to make sure that there was no...
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tuck, ANGDA and AGPA are two very different organizations with very different track records.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Just very simply, who initially were the sponsors of this? I mean, where did this all start? Were there two or three people who filed the paperwork to start the initiative? I mean, what's the genesis of ANGDA?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I do not recall all three of the sponsors, but at least one of the sponsors was Scott Hayworth. Scott Hayworth was appointed by then-Governor Murkowski as one of the first board members at ANGDA, and he has continued in that capacity and was reappointed by Governor Palin last year to the board.
I don't want to blurt out any names, but I think I remember who a couple of the other people were. They may have been hanging around this building, but...
We have Harold on the line. Harold, are you with us? Is he on?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
Hey, Harold, could you tell us who the original initiative sponsors were for the initiative establishing ANGDA?
The statement in support of the initiative, as it was in the official ballot manual distributed list, Scott Hayworth, Mike Macy, and Tyrone Neal as the three names that are shown there. There are a number of other people that were very active, I'm sure, in gathering the signatures. It's just a matter of perspective on that. Ballot measure 3 passed in the 2002 election about 2-1 statewide. It probably outpolled every legislator in every legislative district in Alaska that year. There was opposition from a group called the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. It was contested pretty heavily. Joe's recited a great deal of the early history, but maybe to just kind of put the birth of it all in perspective for you, the initiative was born of frustration that had occurred during Governor Knowles' years, and my way is the highway was the slogan at that time. And there was a frustration on the part of Alaskans that things weren't happening. It was a creation of that frustration. Governor Murkowski came in, and it was not till the summer of 2003 that he appointed the board, and some money was provided for ANGDA to get started. So the official launch date probably was in September of 2003. If you want, I can recite a couple other pieces of the history. I think Joe did a pretty good job of covering it. The first year task ANGDA was given in the uncodified law that was part of the ballot measure was to look at an LNG project not too dissimilar to the one that would have been at that time if you go back and look at the Yukon Pacific project, it was called, and to look at that. It took us 18 months instead of a year to take a look at that. Basically, we concluded the project was economic, competitive, and feasible, but also a very big project and beyond the means of an ANGDA to kind of advance much further at that point. Also at that time, if you remember, the Stranded Gas Act in 2005, 2006 even, was going on. And an LNG project was not part of that scheme of things. During that period, we did focus on the spur line, did obtain a conditional right-of-way for Glen Allen to Palmer. That is considered an asset, probably worth several million dollars easily in terms of both the work and the time involved in getting it. The AGEA process, we did submit an application under that. The application, to answer one of the questions, was very focused on ANGDA being part of a partnership moving forward. It was heavily dependent on a private sector partner in the majority role, actually. And ANGDA saw itself as a retreating partner, and that's the way we defined ourselves in that application. We've never really been that interested in owning and building the pipeline as opposed to making one happen, and making one happen preferably in some sort of public-private partnership mode. Some of the other events of the world that have probably influenced what we focused on at times, certainly last summer, not lost on us, was the incredible rise in oil price and what that was doing to energy costs here in Alaska, and that put a focus and a timeliness focus on us that was significant. For instance, the propane project on the North Slope is something we had always visualized would be part of a big pipeline when built. The use of propane throughout the state was an important element in making sure all Alaskans shared in the North Slope energy. But there was no doubt at the oil price crisis of last summer that the need was to do something now and to advance that, and that's the approach we've taken. We are still continuing to advance the spur line, basically, through the regulatory approval process. We've probably just about eliminated at this point almost all the front end of that project so that any private sector company that would come in has not quite a ready-to-build status, but we're starting to get awful close to that. And that is an advantage in attracting somebody. Just, Madam Chair, while I'm talking here, the important point I would like you to understand about the bill that's before you is that in terms of why it's necessary and all that, it relates in my mind entirely to clarity. I've never felt uncomfortable with the boundaries of what ANGDA was doing under the supervision of its public board, seven board members. But there's no doubt if you were to go out for major financing measured in hundreds of millions of dollars, where bankers read every word and double-check and everything else, that the clarity provided with an amendment like this, I think, is very helpful in that regard. In the longer term, I hope you adopt something like this. I can't tell you that I need it to stay in business tomorrow, but again, I'm not a lawyer, and the legal ramifications and understanding may be is important here also.
Questions for Harold?
Madam Chair, I didn't mean to open an open-ended discussion. I wasn't know if you were ready for that. I just wanted to know who the people who were filed the paperwork with APOC, not who wrote the election pamphlet. And I guess I'll find that after the meeting. But
okay. Any other questions for Harold? Harold, when the initiative passed, you had been tasked with the initiative tasked you with 12. Specific goals in mind, and I'm not sure if they're in statute, but they're obviously referenced in statute. I just wanted to point out the last one is the goal of the authority is to have the Alaskans gas line in full production by 2007, and here we are in 2009, and how much closer are we from 2002 to now in getting in-state gas line?
Madam Chair, Section 5, which was the Section 5 of the initiative petition, which is, again, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska. So you don't find it in the statute, but it was there. The item 11 in that basically is a whole series of plans and other definitions. Was that the goal of the authority is to have the Alaska gas line in full production in 2007. Frankly, we missed. It just did not happen. I think the intent of Section 5 was to provide us with what I'm going to call a first-year task. Beyond that, once it became clear that that was not going to happen, and it had nothing to do with, frankly, our plan or not. That was just not where the world was going at that time. Certainly the governor and the legislature were all focused on going down through Canada. The Port Authority still, at that time, was working towards an LNG project, and basically we backed away and let them have that field to run in. In reflection, I guess I have to say, in fairness to you, I've been at this since probably the first time I encountered gas sales issues was 1969, 1970, here with ARCO. And in particular, I have very strong recollections in the early 70s of working what was called the early gas sales case, which had gas sales starting in 1982. So, you know, that's another one of those we kind of missed. Right now, I would say, in my mind, that things are in good shape for a couple of reasons. One, having two sponsor groups working on a big pipeline down through Canada and being working towards an application in the FERC process is, I think, a very positive thing. Our primary focus is right now is to assure that the in-state side of all these issues is well represented as that process moves forward with FERC. And as you've separately heard from both Denali and from TransCanada, their intention is to be in front of FERC with a filing as early as January of next year. For the in-state side of that, to be prepared to interface with that over, say, a six-month period, somewhere between January and, say, July of 2010, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to be prepared, and that is what we have said as our major priority, is to assure that we're prepared to participate as provided for under the federal legislation that will strictly guide FERC in its proceedings on the Alaska gas pipeline.
Any other questions for Harold while we have him online? And Harold, did you ask for an appropriation this year in the operating budget?
The operating budget, I believe, it contains an amount that's very similar to what's been in the year, several years before. It's a little over $300,000, as I remember. I want to say something, $315,000, something like that. That is comparable to the level we've been at for several years. Basically, the staff of ANGDA consists of myself, an administrative officer, an administrative clerk. We have an additional clerk, but her work basically relates to the capital program, so we charge it there. The question had been asked earlier as to the total sums of money. I think Joe reflected it to you reasonably. We've received something in excess of $10 million of appropriation. If you add up the operating budget and all of those, I think it's probably in the range of about $12 million total. In return for that, you have several projects that are at a point where the private sector can come to them and move forward. I believe that the private sector lacks at this moment the ability to see with certainty that the big pipeline either is going to move forward or, frankly, that it's not going to move forward. And once that certainty, one way or another, is on the table, I think there are a number of pipeline companies that are probably interested in participating here in Alaska.
And Harold, has there been a level of interest from producers on some of the right-of-ways and the things that you've obtained since ANGDA started? Is anybody interested in working with you or purchasing those?
Our conversations, Madam Chair, have been basically with pipeline companies in terms of the work we're doing. I'll just leave it at there are several large lower 48 pipeline companies that have certainly expressed interest for instance, in a spur line project, as we've defined it. And they place a large stead of their interest in the fact that not only has the front-end process been shortened, but the risk elements of it have been greatly decreased. The deal in our conversations with everybody has always been that if they were to use those things that we paid for and did with the public money, that the public treasury would be reimbursed for all those costs and that the money basically would be paid back.
Any other questions for Harold while we have him online? Thanks, Harold. It is now 12:10, Joe, and I apologize that we went long, but we will be holding on to this legislation to take public testimony on both bills, and then we will hear them under bills previously heard at a later date, and we'll make sure we get in contact with you. And with that, any comments from the committee members?
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Edgman?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, I will adjourn the Special Committee on Energy at 12:10.